Into the Mystic with Van Morrison, an appropriate segue from Nick Redfern into our next topic. I had never heard of Manly Palmer Hall until a month or so ago when I saw the title of this book, and it grabbed me. The title is Master of the Mysteries. I thought, well, that sounds like something maybe we could talk about. And then I saw the photo on the cover of the book, and there's this mesmerizing guy who looks like he could be a silent movie star or something, or a mad monk. Manly Palmer Hall was a colossus in the metaphysical world in Hollywood for decades. He became the 20th century's most prolific writer and speaker on ancient philosophies, mysticism, and magic. He was a confidant of Hollywood celebrities and politicians, everyone from Elvis and Ronald Reagan to John Denver to Osama bin Laden were interested in what he had wrote and said. He had a library, traveled the world collecting information on a wide range of topics. He had a library of 30,000 or so volumes. He wrote 200 books, countless articles, magazines and newspapers, and gave something like 8,000 different public speeches to overflow crowds. The guy was a giant in his field. In 1990, he died at the age of 89, and the guy who was working the desk at the LA Times, who took a call that suggested, hey, you better start working on an obit about this guy, is my next guest. His name is Louis Sahagun. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, and I think you're going to love this topic and love this book. We'll be right back with more on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Louis Sahagun is a staff writer at the LA Times, covers issues ranging from religion, culture, and the environment to crime, politics, and water. He was part of the team of LA Times writers that earned the Pulitzer Prize in Public Service and was a finalist in 2015 for another Pulitzer. His new book, Master of the Mysteries, New Revelations on the Life of Manly Palmer Hall, is absolutely fascinating, about a colossus of a man. Louis, welcome to the program for the first time.
Thank you for having me.
I tell you, I'm looking at the photo on the cover of your book, and in my head, I've already cast the movie. It should be Matthew McConaughey as this guy. Because I mean,
bad.
Don't you think that would work?
Not bad. Sure, why not? That photo was actually taken by William Mortensen, who was back in the day, a famous Hollywood photographer who took some of the most memorable portraits of Marlene Dietrich, for example. He was also Gene Harlow was another. He also was a set photographer for, I believe it was the King of Kings in 1927. But he was a friend of Hall's. He had an interest in things occult, and he lived in Laguna Canyon. And Manly Hall and his first wife, Faye, used to hang out at William Mortensen's home, and they had seances, and they had all kinds of occult fun.
I have to make an admission to you that I am still reading the book. I haven't finished it. I kind of thought, well, I'm just going to cruise through it here and get the gist of it, but it's really good, and I didn't want to just skip through it. I wanted to take my time because it's excellent, and I think the Coast audience will really like it. Master of what mysteries? Who was this guy? And what did he know?
Manly Hall taught that there were enduring values and core knowledge at the beginning of history of humankind, and that these notions were applicable for all time, including to help remedy, for example, modern anxieties. And so he was carrying, the trudgel, if you will, for the ancients. And he was suspicious of science, and he thought that these notions could help people get through, life, of modern times in this growing metropolis that was Los Angeles. And there were a lot of people, and he also dangled this carrot in front of noses high and low, that there were also accompanying this knowledge was information and ways of living that could help you get an edge on you know, life itself by bending the rules of nature. You would become more prosperous. You would die peacefully. You would live happily. That is not what happened, unfortunately, with Manly Hall himself.
I mean, if he were around today, maybe he'd be a TV preacher.
Well, he was a preacher, and perhaps he would be. But he was also, you know, suggested that he was also, you know, something of almost a sorcerer. And this attracted the interest, and this is what fascinated me so much, that attracted the interest of people who, you know, were surprisingly influential, like Mayor Yorty of Los Angeles, like Governor Goodwin Knight of California, Governor Goodwin Knight, President Truman had his books on his bookshelf. Many, many movie stars, from Glenn Ford to Burl Ives to, as you say, John Denver. Now, the thing about it is, I am a reporter, and you are too. And you know, I did not get into this. I did not write this book looking for truth or trying to understand any metaphysical, you know, notion and
right.
adopt it in my life. I wanted to know who was this man. After I learned that there were suspicious circumstances surrounding his death at, you know, at the Los Angeles Police Department. When I learned that, I decided I really wanted to get to know this guy. And once I started talking to people who knew him, family members, close friends, the notion, you know, the contradictions, you know, in their, you know, in their memories, in the notions that Hall was espousing, were. They were fascinating to me. How could it be that people so, you know, so influential in society, for example, would want to, you know, get to know Hall? Well, I know what it was. They were trying to get an edge on competition. That goes for movie stars. It goes for, you know, politicians like Mayor Yorty. They chummed up to Hall, hoping that some kind of magic or edge,
sure.
you know, on the competition would rub off.
Yeah, just in case it was all true. You know what I
yeah,
like
yeah,
about
exactly, exactly.
What I like about your approach is you're not putting this guy on a pedestal, but you're not out to knock him off one either.
No, I'm not at all. It is what it is. Reporters turn over stones, and whatever, you know, hops out from underneath, it is what it is. I have to tell you that I was stunned when I began my investigation and talked to close friends, very close. For example, well, there was this interesting dichotomy between people who were close friends and family members. Manly Hall's own stepdaughter and stepson want nothing to do with esotericism or metaphysics, nothing at all. And why is that? It's because of their experience with Manly and his second wife, Marie, primarily, behind closed doors. After the, you know, adoring crowds would leave, they knew Manly and Marie behind closed doors. And they, and when, you know, they knew them to be not magic at all. On the other hand, they were close friends. And I can, if you don't mind, I'll give you an example of what I mean. Fred
Sure.
Cole. Fred Cole was a close friend of Manly and his second wife, Marie, for almost 50 years. Very close. He donated thousands of dollars of his hard-earned money as an electrician to help Marie in her effort to find, believe it or not, she believed that Lord Bacon secretly crossed the Atlantic in the 1600s and buried secrets to world peace and unknown Shakespeare plays. And you know, with enough money and with enough, you know, people of influence supporting her, she would go dig it up and give it to the world. Little Marie, German immigrant who even in her own writing, and by her own admission, was prone to hallucinations. and blackouts and all kinds of things. Anyway, Fred Cole, I was interviewing him, and he said, "Well, you know, Lewis, you understand, don't you, that Manly Hall, it was the culmination of hundreds of karmic reincarnations from Pythagoras all the way to Madame Blavatsky. And he was such an advanced adept," he said in whispers. "Lewis, Manly was half woman and half man, like the super advanced adepts he wrote about and taught us about." And I said, "Fred, how do you know that? Honest to God, how do you know that, Fred?" And he said, "Well, Lewis, once I was over Manly's house, and he just came out of the shower, and he had a bathrobe on. That bathrobe flew open, and I couldn't help but take a peek. Do you know what I mean?" I said, "I know what you mean, Fred." And he said, "Well, that's how I know." And I said, "Fred, I've seen the autopsy pictures, Fred. That is not the case, buddy."
Let me ask you this. So you get a call in 1990, you're working at the LA Times, you get a call that suggests, "Hey, you guys should put together an obit on this guy Manly Hall." Had you ever heard of him before?
No. It was, I was working the late shift on a Saturday evening, I believe it was, on September 2nd, 1990. It was just me and the editor in the newsroom, a slow night. And hot night, slow night, and, you know, waiting for, you know, to write about, you know, crime and mayhem and horrible traffic accidents. I get this phone call, and this tipster says, "The greatest philosopher of our time has died. You'll want to get an obit ready." And I said, "Yeah, I hadn't seen any such thing on the wires, you know, UPI, Associated Press, what have you." And I said, "Who might that be?" And he said, "Manly P. Hall." And I said, "Could you repeat the name?" And he says, Manly P. Hall." And I said, "Spell it." I took his name and number. I went downstairs to the LA Times morgue, and I looked up Manly Hall. And lo and behold, there were hundreds, many hundreds, several hundred articles about Manly Hall that we had written, dating back to the early 1920s, about Manly Hall, all the way through, all the way up to the 1980s, including when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, for example. Manly Hall was so influential at that time. He was such a bright light that editors at the LA Times apparently sent report, you better go talk to Manly Hall and see what he thinks about the Japanese bombing Pearl Harbor. What does this mean? And they wrote stories about that. Manly Hall says not to worry. You know what I mean? Amazing.
So you start piecing together and you realize, geez, this guy was a colossus. He was a giant of his time. He wrote about everything, spoke about everything, ESP, UFOs, mysticism, all kinds of stuff. How far are you along in your research in the morgue before you realize this should be a book?
Actually, not yet. I saw all of this. I was on a tight deadline, okay? And I went back upstairs and talked to the editor. I said, "Hey, this Manly Hall died. He's over there not far from here. We probably should get a obit. We've got hundreds of articles down there." The editor says, "Well, look at the, you know, we've only got time. We've only got a few minutes, Lewis. How about 10 paragraphs?" So I wrote the 10 paragraphs. So I wrote the obit for the Los Angeles Times of Manly Hall. And yes, I have to admit, it was, you know, it was lacking. It was 10 paragraphs. I wrote, it began like this. "Manly Palmer Hall, an eclectic philosopher and founder of the Philosophical Research Society, has died at 89. The Society reported Sunday. The peripatetic philosopher who authored more than 200 books and gave more than 8,000 lectures, many of them from a throne-like chair at the Society's Los Angeles headquarters, died in his sleep Wednesday of natural causes," a spokesman said. Now, a few years later, I would learn that spokesman, the guy who called the Times, was the chief suspect in the LAPD's open homicide. It remains an open homicide file in Manley's death. That fellow is the chief suspect. He is now dead, I might add. But so when I learned that there was a homicide file and there was this, a bare knuckles lawsuit over control of Manley's treasures at his headquarters in Los Feliz, Los Angeles, the Philosophical Research Society, that's when I decided, oh my goodness, all those clips, open homicide file, he's the master of the mysteries, he's supposed to know, you know, he taught that if you live right, if you study these symbols, if you learn these ways, you will die peacefully, you'll be fine. But his life, you know, his life ended anything but fine. When the body pickup team arrived at his house, and we'll talk about this later, I'm sure, in detail, but they found him on his bed without a wrinkle on the bed. Dan Fritz, his assistant, the guy who called me, called the mortuary to come and pick up the body, and they found him with thousands of ants crawling out of his eyes, nose, ears, crawling out, not in.
He'd been dead for days.
No, he'd actually been dead for about a day or several hours. But it appears as though the deal is this. Manly Hall, at the very end day, in his last days on Earth, he and his assistant, Dan Fritz, were trying to apply Paracelsian, alternative medicine technique, Paracelsus, a medieval magician doctor. Paracelsus believed that ants would cart off bad vibrations from a person, and also through their urine. Dan and Manley were mixing their urine, believe it or not, and pouring it on the sun-facing side of a tree in Manley's yard, Manley's home in Los Feliz, over an anthill, so that ants would carry off the bad vibes. That's what they thought. They were trying to apply these medieval notions. And then Hall died, and what it looks like, the only police found a jar of molasses on Manley's bedstand, and so did the doctor who signed off on his death certificate, and so did the body pickup team. So there's Manley. You can't even see his face. It's so full of ants crawling out of his head. And there's a jar of molasses on the bedstead. It indicates that Dan Fritz and his assistants, when Manley died or with their assistants he died, then they stuffed him, put some molasses in his head, in his orifices, and then took him outside, rolled him around, brought him back in, thinking that they were doing the right thing, believe
it. Didn't you write in the book that there was some kind of strange stain that they were trying to clean out of the carpet or something?
Well, actually, there was a crew that was cleaning the strange brown stains off the rug, ants pouring out of Manley's head. Dan Fritz's assistants are carting Manley's valuables and belongings out of his home and into his truck and driving off with them. That was the scene. These are the suspicious circumstances that, you know, not unreasonably led to a homicide investigation.
Hey, we're going to go to a break in about a minute. Did they actively investigate it for a while? I mean, I don't know how much of the police file you've got.
They investigated the heck out of it. They went to the DA four times, begging the DA to file homicide charges. But the DA said, unless we can prove homicide, that he was murdered, without a doubt, I'm not taking this to court. But the cause of death was amended four times over the next 10 years or so. And so the doctor said initially that Hall died of natural causes.
Lewis, I'm going to have to interrupt you there. Music is telling us we're going to take a break. Lewis Hagen is my guest. Master of the Mysteries is his book, talking about the amazing life of Manly Palmer Hall. When we come back, we're going to start tracing his life, the rise of Manly Hall, and how he became the giant that he became in Hollywood and in the metaphysical world. Much more to come. Paul McCartney, a song called Down to the River. Chances are pretty good you've never heard it before because it was never released in the U.S. or the U.K. I think it came out on the second album of one of his albums that was only released in the Netherlands and I think Japan. So if you can find that, it's a great album. The second record in the two album set is maybe better than the first one. We're talking about Master of the Mysteries, the life of Manly Palmer Hall, who had an amazing life. He had people from Ronald Reagan and Harry Truman and Elvis and John Denver, even Osama bin Laden, who were fascinated with what he wrote and what he said. When we come back, we're going to hear the story from Lewis Hagen about how he became this colossus in the metaphysical world and the peaks that he reached. Stick around. Much more to come. Lewis Hagen, you know, people in the rest of the country look at Southern California with a certain amount of disdain. Some of it is fair, some of it is not so fair, but the image of L.A. in particular and Hollywood as being sort of a metaphysical hotbed where, you know, the home to all kinds of UFO cults and belief in ESP and strange oddball religions and cults and trends and crazes that start there and spread from somewhere else. And I would think that the place that is fertile ground for all kinds of things with wild imaginations would be a perfect place for a guy like Manly Palmer Hall. Tell me the story of him arriving there, what the atmosphere was like, and why it was a good fit.
Well, Hall had a birth story. We won't go into it, but it bore no relation to what actually happened. Here's his story in a minute or two. He was a nobody from nowhere who by 27, 25 years of age was helping give birth to a vibrant subculture in California, informing the growth, the unfoldment of one of the greatest cities on earth, Los Angeles. He was born in Peterborough, Ontario, in 1901. His father abandoned his mother as soon as his father was a pretty well-off dentist. He abandoned his mother, Louise, as soon as he knew she was pregnant. She had him, and then by age three, she handed him over to Grandma and took off to be a chiropractor in the Alaskan gold fields. Manly and Grandma came down from Canada to the United States and crisscrossed for the next several years. Hall never finished sixth grade. He never knew his father. He arrived in Los Angeles at the age of 18 to reunite with his mother after his grandmother died. He was a big 6'4", 18-year-old without fixed points and no education. And he was strolling down the arcade one day in Santa Monica, and he met a Civil War doctor and phrenologist, you know, a reader of bumps on your head. And they became fast friends. And this little old man introduced Manly to esoteric notions and metaphysical ideas, and then even helped him deliver his first lecture over a bank down the street. They made 65 cents, or Manly made 65 cents of donations, and they splurged on ice cream. Next thing you know, Hall he keeps giving lectures, and he starts developing a very interesting and persuasive delivery where he's sitting alone on stage and he speaks for 90 minutes on the most arcane, esoteric notions you can imagine. And he ends then after 90 minutes without a sip of water. He ends with a folksy sign-off along the lines of, well, that's all for tonight, folks. People thought that he was channeling from some great beyond. His mother, Louise, when Manly came back to L.A. and reunited with her at age of 18, he learned that she was fascinated in some of these notions, which were springing up all over in Southern California, almost like, you know, it's been compared to maybe the miscellaneous drawer in your kitchen. If you tilt it, if you pull it out and tilt it, all the nuts and bolts seem to roll into the southwestern corner. That was L.A. at the time. But it was also a place where there were a lot of Rosicrucians and theosophists. And it was a place of, it was like a greenhouse of ambitious immigrants and free thinkers and Freemasons and fringe Christians. And they were building, changing the landscape with these, with meditation gardens and ashrams and temples and occult lodges and churches. So Hall, he's absorbing these things like a sponge, and suddenly, within no time flat, he's a popular speaker. He takes over a church in downtown LA called the Church of the People, 600 congregants, and they were a very diverse group. At the age of 22, he becomes its official minister, and one of the congregants included Carolyn Lloyd. Carolyn Lloyd was she belonged to a family that controlled one of the largest oil fields, most productive oil fields in California history. And she told Hall at the age of 22, she said, young man, you will never, ever need, you'll never have to worry about money. And so she arranged legally to have dividends, portions of her dividends, sent to Hall for his whole life. He never had to worry about money.
Yeah, after she died, you said he was in the will. He got a house and
He got $10,000 to $15,000, and her daughter Estelle, a friend of Ernest Hemingway's, by the way, she was even more generous in her own will and in her own legal arrangements with Hall. So try to imagine. So next thing you know, he publishes his magnum opus, which is the Secret Teachings of All Ages. But the formal name is An Encyclopedic Outline of Masonic, Hermetic, Kabbalistic, and Rosicrucian Symbolical Philosophy.
It's an amazing piece of work, right? It's amazing.
Enormous, beautiful. It is enormous. It's beautiful. It's easy to read. It's fascinating. It's also, I'm not sure that, it's not necessarily anymore. I don't think anybody would, well, some people might, but it's not all that factual. But so what? It's a lot of fun to hold, to look at, to page through. But the publication of that book catapulted him into, at that time, national fame. He was chumming. Imagine, at the age of 27, 26, he's chumming with movie stars, with politicians, and they want to know him. And so as time goes on, he starts to write screenplays for friends, including Bela Lugosi, of course, Boris Karloff. And he actually gets as far as finally he actually scripted the only motion picture ever made with a murder mystery motion picture ever made with astrology as the plot. And it starred his friend Anna May Wong. It was released in 1938. It's a Warner Brothers movie called When Were You Born? And the movie's terrible. But nonetheless, it was the first of its kind. But more importantly, Hall he made that movie, and it was made because he had persuaded some very important people in Hollywood that this was untrammeled ground for movie making, that movies with myths in their plots, with that this would be a new way of reaching out to an audience and actually teaching people about these enduring values like self-discipline and courage and these kinds of things. So you could actually, and I do believe that he set the groundwork, he laid the groundwork for movies like Star Wars.
Yeah, he wasn't wrong.
Harry Potter. He was not wrong at all. Look at the biggest movies of our time are the very kinds of movies that he was trying to tell Hollywood it needed to pay attention to.
He started traveling the world with this financial freedom that he had, traveling the world, collecting volumes, collecting esoteric knowledge, and then weaving it into this enormous narrative that he developed. Talk a little bit about the collection process, and then share with us sort of some general themes that are carried through his masterwork and then through the rest of his life.
What he did, he did, like a lot of people at the time, he built a library. Now, some people built libraries about railroading or gold mining or whatever. It was a thing to do in California after the turn of the last century. Hall built a metaphysical library like no other. And by 1934, he had enough support, financial support and political support, to build a headquarters with a Mayan-themed architecture called the Philosophical Research Society, and it exists today in Los Feliz. His idea was to create a place where people could get a mystical counterpoint to science, which was coming rolling down the track like a freight train at the time. But he thought that he would help at his headquarters imbue this technological society, this post-industrial society that was blossoming in LA in many different ways, with a kind of ethos and kind of enduring values that would make it a kind of mystical capital of the world, of planet Earth. And he would be school children there to become almost like, little Platos that would go out and make our lives a better place, make our lives more comfortable and peaceful. He was also, though, an incredible patriot. So he develops this place, and then people were surprised to learn, some people in LA, when he would preach that, urge people to enlist to go fight the Japanese and the Germans during World War II, and he did later. People would write him saying, "Manly, I need your help to get out of I've been drafted into the army. I don't want to go to Vietnam. I need your help." And he would write back, and I have some of those letters, "Dear Matt, you need to buckle up. You need to gather your courage and go fight those communists. Otherwise, they're going to take over our country. Now get a hold of yourself and get out there and fight."
The guy you describe in the book, I mean, there's a lot of positive stuff here. He was preaching certain kinds of values and patriotism and a sort of good karma and suggestions for how to live. He just didn't follow his own rules. But I mean, there's a lot of good stuff in there.
He didn't follow very many of his own rules. And this was the big problem. And I believe this is one of the reasons that no one else has tackled a biography of Manly Hall. I think that people who had thought about it, who have thought about it, ran into the contradictions. and banged their head against them and just decided, you know, I'm not going to write, or they thought they it would, you know, rather than write negatively about Manly Hall, they'd rather not write at all. In fact, there were attempts in Manly's life to write biographies, but the people who were writing them were lousy writers, or the products, one I'm thinking of, ran over 600 pages and didn't make any sense. So the publishers turned it down. Manly preached that you should, you know, that proper diet was important to proper thinking and proper living, but he couldn't keep his hands off chocolate cake. He had his thyroid removed in 1940, and doctors warned him, the effects of this removal of your thyroid in your case is a propensity toward obesity.
But to tell the reason why he had the thyroid taken out, that's a pretty interesting story.
Well, I'm not exactly sure what the medical issues were involving that, but I do know it was removed in 1940, and he ballooned crazily, and doctors forever after were warning, hey, Manly, you can't eat all those sweets. But he was addicted to junk food, even though he would preach that, you know, proper diet and exercise were important.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I thought you had said, intimated in the book that somehow he thought that taking the thyroid out would somehow give him a better control over making decisions or remove something.
No, actually, no. Manly, it was interesting that Manly throughout his life, this is also fascinating to me, he would preach something, for example, that celibacy, for example, when he was very young, he would write about the importance of celibacy as an aspect of the path toward enlightenment. But in 1928, before he married his first wife, Faye, his secretary of 5 years, he then started writing a new batch of essays that said, well, you know, on the other hand, Buddha was married, Sophocles was married, all these great spiritual leaders were married. So it's actually quite fine. He would bend the rule later in life. He would say, you know, he would write, for example, that, you know, Madame Blavatsky taught us that the heart is the seat of the unique karmic soul of each individual, and et cetera, et cetera, and cannot be, you know, this is like, you know, and, you know, the most sacred, you know, place in existence is your own heart, and it shouldn't be messed with. However, when he got into his 60s, and his doctor said, well, you know, Manly, you with all that weight, and you got some heart issues going here. And then he wrote a new batch of essays saying, well, you know, now that we can transplant hearts, maybe it's not a bad idea. Get through bells. So the thing about Hall, you know, a lot of people think that he believed he had a comprehensive notion of mysticism that he was dishing out, but he didn't. He was a collector of ideas. But one of the problems is that one reason people thought that is he never attributed the knowledge he was dispensing in his lectures to a name, to Confucius, to whoever. And so people thought, wow, he knows this. He channeled this information. So
he gathered all this stuff and sort of regurgitated it.
He never credited the people right. He was gathering it from. So people came to believe, man, this guy must be the real deal.
Well, I mean, I give him credit for just absorbing an incredible amount of material. The guy cast a pretty wide net.
He did. He had those 30,000 books. He had a photographic memory. He was silver-tongued. He also was 6'4", wide in the middle all his life, like an avocado. So people looked at him with his long hair and on that throne-like chair on stage. Speaking for 90 minutes, looking, his eyes darting back over the heads of his audience, almost as though he was reading off a scroll that was, you know, unfurling over their heads. He wasn't. He was remembering what he had read.
And he was charismatic. Women were crazy about him, I guess you said at one point.
Women were crazy about him. He was homosexual, which was, he... you know, it was interesting. You know, by the way, I'm not sure how deep into these weeds you want to go. Today, it would mean nothing. If
yeah.
you're gay, so what?
But back then, it would have been a pretty big deal.
It was a big deal, and it was a big deal in terms of hiding it and marrying for convenience and not, you know, it was a big deal with his second wife, Marie, who couldn't stop telling, you know, confiding to friends and their family doctor, who I interviewed, by the way, that Manly, you know, had affairs with fellows. And it got pretty grim and scary in terms of his relationship with Dan Fritz when it
right.
comes to enemas. And
Louis Sahagun is my guest, talking about his new book, The Master of the Mysteries, about Manly Palmer Hall. When we come back, I'm going to talk about whether or not he had grandiose claims of special powers and how he eventually helped law enforcement against some fraudulent folks who were in the same kind of line of work. Go into the break with the Gin Blossoms. We'll be right back.